to episode 4 of the Watcher podcast. Ben and I were just talking and we agreed that one of the ingredients of this show is anger. What are we angry about right this minute?
Well, this minute we're angry about the system, but that's usually generalized.
All right, so what are we gonna talk about this episode then?
I've been thinking a lot about the myth of American success, really just kind of the myth of American success. Years ago, I took a college course that I really enjoyed called History of American Popular Culture. Mm-hmm. And the writers of the book for that course decided to include the myth of American success. As a matter of fact, I think it was the first chapter, because it's really the oldest pop culture myth. And I'd like to say, oh, it's because America was founded on an ideal, you know. And there's a quote, I don't know who said it, but, America was the first country founded on an idea. It might have been Jimmy Carter that said that. And that's true. You know, most other countries at the time America was founded, you know, had their own nationalistic history, generally speaking. You know, then Australia came along and things like that. But for the most part, you know, America was founded on we don't want a king. You know, we want to decide our own fates.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't know. Do people overseas have that? I mean, is that something uniquely American that I just said, or?
I don't know. I don't know, because that part of it sounds a little bit like myth making to me. Because the very beginning for me is like a bunch of people who have a tremendous opportunity to show up somewhere and take everything, and then use slavery to get rich, and then say, hey, anybody can succeed here.
I'm at the very beginning when they were just mad taxes and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I dig that. Like, I mean, I come from a country that has quite a similar, like Ireland has the Republic of Ireland, the independent part of Ireland has quite a similar ethos. But I don't know. I feel like it's infected from the start, but that's something we can...
But I think you're right. I think that you're right about that it is infected from the start. Like, if your nation is founded on the idea of, you know, rugged individualism, not being pushed around by some king and deciding your own fate, then it would seem that it would follow that the harder you worked at your own fate.
Yes.
Not saying that that's a true statement, because, you know, it's not, you know, the reality of the world is not that by any means. I think that it's interesting too, if you were to take the two parties in America and try to decide which one believed in that idea, pushed that ideal more for their own ends, it would definitely be the Republicans.
Uh-huh.
They pushed that into the lift you up by your own bootstraps idea and compassionate conservatism. And
what a great phrase.
Just enough money to, you know, think that you're a part of society, but not really. And
yeah.
And I think that it also, you know, the myth of American success is that the harder you work, the more successful you'll become, by the way, since we haven't really explained what we're talking about.
Yeah, and to some degree that it is that success is independent of your beginnings.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Probably maybe the most important part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there's social mobility, and that is just on a terrible decline in this country. As the middle class disappears, so does social mobility. It's ridiculous to think that's a fallacy. The harder you work, the more successful you'll become. You don't have control over outside events.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sometimes Americans fool themselves into believing that they can surpass outside events that they don't have control over. I think that maybe Trump has brought some of that fear to the fore. Like, people are starting to realize that maybe that's not true.
Yeah.
There's such an egocentrism in this country sometimes. And I think that maybe Trump has kind of blown that veneer off, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because I think if you tell people that you will succeed no matter what, if you just work hard, you will succeed. And then if you start telling them, oh, but by the way, the reason you're not succeeding is brown people. Then yeah. Like then both of those statements, you know, you can keep those two statements. Consistent, even though they're both lies. Sorry, say it again.
That's what the Republican Party chose to do.
Right.
I mean, in essence, there's no way around it. Even when they were told they were doing it, they would just turn it back. Well, no, I'm not the racist. You're the racist for thinking I'm a racist, you know, but
yeah,
that's what they chose to do. You know, that's why, you know, they're failing, because that's not what the arc of history is. They should have known it. I think it's deeper than that, though. And I'll say it this way. Like, there's a friend of mine, a European friend of mine, who lives in America now. And he talks about, he can't figure out why every crazy thing that Trump does, we're not just all in the streets just freaking out, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know. There is like 300 million of us. So the chances of all of us getting in the streets get dramatically smaller the more of people there are, I think.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I mean, you can motivate maybe a city's worth of people or two, three cities worth of people, but I mean, most European nations are about the size of one of our states.
Right.
So to organize that many people is a whole other ball game. But I also think that a lot of it has to do with, you know, the myth of American success and rugged individualism, in that, you know, well, I can fix this. I don't need to be out on the streets with, you know, 500 other, you know, 5 million other people.
Yeah.
Like, I think that maybe we're disenabling ourselves from that kind of collective action.
That's interesting. That's interesting. I had never made that connection in my head at all. That sort of rugged individualism of like, you can make it if you try, kind of isolates you from group action, which is how things actually get done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've always felt that, well, even done, you know, like road tax, we'll take for instance, you know, like everybody gets up in arms about a road tax, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's because I think that one of the reasons Americans are so tax averse is rugged individualism. Why should I pay for something unconsciously, even, you know, why should I pay for someone else to have a better road when I can just find a better road, or not care about the road, or
yeah.
And maybe roads aren't a good example, but I mean, I think that's what a lot of anti-tax Americans are about, whether they know it or not. They feel like they're not part of a collective because of that, you know, rugged individualism that comes with being an American.
Yeah.
I think it makes us a little obnoxious too. I do.
How so?
Well, you know, I mean, I've been abroad, and even when I was abroad, Americans were looked upon as obnoxious. And
really?
I think a lot. Well, yeah, and we kind of are.
I'm a fan. I like Americans. I have a lot of American friends. I can say that I come from Dublin, where Americans are regarded in a very ambivalent way.
Well, that's the best I could hope for, I guess.
Yeah, like, you know, the one thing that I love about Americans, right, and about America, is that there's a willingness to engage in hyperbole. There's a willingness to say, yeah, but we could turn it up to 11. Like, why don't we turn it up to 11, which isn't found everywhere. And that's I love that about Americans. There you go.
I can see that. Yeah. Well, isn't that a little obnoxious, though?
It's sometimes a good thing can be a byproduct of a bad thing.
I'll take that.
Okay. Yeah, there you go. There you are, buddy.
Well, there's plenty of obnoxious people that I just love to death, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Like, you know, I'm not saying obnoxious necessarily makes us bad.
Yeah.
We're just unafraid, I think, sometimes. I mean, you run around thinking you saved the world for two generations, three generations. What are you going to get?
Yeah.
I mean, I really do think a lot of that is what it is. Like, the post-World War II America, Like, and I, you know, the funny thing is, and we swing this back to what we're talking about. Like, I think that America was at like this crux point with this rugged individualism crap, you know, like we had just gotten the Roosevelt New Deal going and people were feeling a little more collective, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we can do it, you know? And then World War II comes around and we save the fucking world. Right. And then suddenly it just shoots off, you know?
Well, okay. What's interesting then for me is the question of like, how could America have ever pulled together more than they did for World War II, but yet in the aftermath, it goes the opposite way?
What do you mean?
Like America banded together amazingly, right? For World War II?
Oh, in the aftermath, it goes because of the rhythm. Every soldier had his own story. Every family had their own story about their soldier, and every town had their own story. But you know what's funny is you're right, though, because after that period of time, it started to be, we were like mini democracies everywhere. Like, it did bring us closer together. Like, the unions took off real fast, you know?
Uh-huh.
And that's a mini democracy, you know? It's PTA organizations and schools. Well, that's a mini democracy, you know? And we had those all over the country. Other countries came to our country to check out how well we collectively worked in a democracy.
That is an interesting one. Yeah.
Yep. And it went away again.
Yeah. I read an article about that just recently about the sort of decline of American participation in group stuff like that. And yeah, right. It is. It's strange to think that at one time America was the paragon of organizing for the greater good.
You know how sometimes I blame generations for shifts in America?
Yeah, I've heard you do that.
I blame my generation for that shift, actually.
Oh, really? Generation?
Yeah, we have the lowest civic engagement of any generation. It's changing a little bit now. There's a lot of Xers that ran this past year, and I think that it might change more. But we're like the original don't give a fuck generation in this country, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that my generation combined with the movement conservative takeover of American politics increased the decline of labor unions and PTA participation and things like that to shift us back to this rugged individualism crap, you know? Because like if Trump had happened in the 70s, people would have been in the streets instantly.
That's really interesting.
But not so much now, you know?
Yeah.
Now, then the question is, though, does every nation go through this kind of cycle?
Maybe. The cycle of participation and less participation, or the cycle of like drifting towards the right? Which cycle?
Oh, I would definitely think that nations drift politically left and right, probably in cycles. I haven't really done a lot of reading about that, but that seems like a natural human phases to me. I mean, it seems like natural human phases to me, but I mean, I think that, what was the other cycle? The other cycle was, I lost my train of thought.
Participation and non-participation.
Oh, yeah, participation. I think so. And I think, and I bet, and I'd be willing to bet that if you look back, a lot of that happens to coincide when the government starts to go bad, too, at least in our nation. I don't know that. I mean, I'm not, you know, we don't Google here, so I'm not going to go research it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the old chestnut of like, you know, you're lucky in your nation's politics when you start to forget the names of politicians and you start to forget who's in charge of what.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're not worried about it all the time.
Right. Well, I mean, like, but you know what? Now you have to, though. I tweeted something just this morning about Ken Blackwell. He was on television. And this guy, you know, he's on TV, like, preaching comedy over, you know, George H.W. Bush's casket, basically. You know, we should all get along and stuff. And this guy was suppressing voters in 2004 for George W. Bush, his son.
Yeah.
And nobody... That party is ridiculous, dude. It's unbelievable they're able to fail up like that. It's just unbelievable. I never seen anything like that.
The whole the whole can't we all just get along thing reminds me of it's always the kid that pushes the other kids into the puddles. It's always the kid that bullies the other kids that says, hey, learn how to take a joke, will you?
That's exactly what that is. Although, you know what, though? I think it's worse than that, though. I don't even think that they're saying learn how to take a joke. I think that they actually know that they're picking. Now, it used, like, I could have bought that before the Trump era. But since really they're just running around saying they want to own the libs, I mean, come on.
No, it's man. I mean,
we're just trying to pick at you, you know?
I fundamentally believe the phrase learn how to take a joke or where is your sense of humor has nothing to do with joking or humor. Either version of that phrase is, hey, don't bother me with consequences.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got what you were saying. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
That's the real meaning of that. No matter whoever's saying it, that's what they're really saying.
Yeah, I was a sensitive kid, man. I had more than a couple people tell me, why can't you take a joke?
Yeah, me too, man.
You know, like that kid that used to sit behind you. That's always the worst. That kid that sat behind you and flicked things at you.
Yeah.
And turn around and look the other way and be like, motherfucker, you know. And people like that, they do it just to get a rise. And I think that might be what the Republican Party is turning into. Mm-hmm. But the base of that party, the base voter of that party, they're just sticking it in the eye, man, of the rest of the world. That's all they're doing now. A big F you.
That is a weird situation. But that, like, it's so weird because the base, right, is such a tiny number. The actual base, right?
Yeah, they're about 25%, 26% of Americans.
Like, that's crazy.
Well, I mean, it's not a tiny number, really. It's what, 70, let me think. Probably what, 75, right around 75 million people, 80 million people. That's not about right.
Yeah, we'll call it a tiny proportion then.
You know, people talking about one of these days we need to talk about the Senate and what that is all about, the U.S. Senate and why it exists. Because when you think about it, it feels really illogical, but it's not. You know,
let's put it on the board. I'm into that. Yeah.
Totally on the board. I want to talk about the House sometime too. Like, there's all these really Byzantine rules and stuff, and they've, like, the Senate, the rules have changed over the last probably 10 years or so that have made things much more confrontational in the House.
Let's Schoolhouse Rock this shit. Definitely.
I'm just a bill.
Yeah. I'm totally into that. By the way, didn't grow up in a country with Schoolhouse Rock, so I discovered it via the movie Reality Bites.
Oh, well, Schoolhouse Rock was awesome. I literally grew up on that. Like, I personally believe, if I believed in psychic things or anything that was like supernatural, I would think that maybe Schoolhouse Rock might prove it to me. Because when I was a little kid, I would always think, oh, I really want to see this one. And that one would come on.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, that one and that old Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, same thing.
Oh, good shit.
That was good shit, man. I was sad that show never made it. They've never successfully made Dungeons and Dragons into anything other than the game.
They 100% have not. Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly.
There was a couple of movies, I don't know, a few years back. They were just awful.
So terrible.
There's some great licenses there, too.
Yeah, totally. There's lots of great material. But okay, all right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Geeking.
Where are we?
I apologize.
Yeah, no, I could do this all day. But let's get back to shaking our heads in disgust at the lie.
But it is the lie.
Yeah.
And you know what? Actually, as we were thinking about it, and it's so funny that we would geek out, because there's a strong argument to be made that the myth of American rugged individualism, the myth of American success and all that, when it was on its way out during the New Deal period and everybody was feeling all collective, and after the war and unions were starting and all that, but corporations capitalized on that old rugged Western ideal. And I think that there's a strong argument to be made that corporations brought that poison back into our nation.
I can go for that. I can absolutely go for that.
The Marlboro Man.
Yeah. I mean, look at the explosion of Westerns in the 50s.
Ah, G.I. Joe toys.
Yeah.
All kinds of things.
I mean, I didn't grow up there, but my, you know, I'm a movie guy, I'm a movie fan and stuff. And through reading and stuff, from a pop culture point of view, America was like, there was a period in the 50s where it seemed like more entertainment was Western based than not. You know what I mean? Like, if there was a new TV show, oh, it's a Western, by the way.
Yeah.
And look, I love Westerns, by the way. But the West. There's a narrative there. Sorry?
I do too. There was a long period after the 70s of no Westerns, too. And I love a Western, too, actually.
Yeah.
I even like the spaghetti Westerns, the European ones. I really think those are good.
Yeah.
And as much as Clint Eastwood is a weird, weird dude, I think his movies, his Westerns are really good.
Yeah, same here. I mean, look, Outlaw Josie Wales has been one of my favorite Westerns my whole life. A couple of years ago, I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to read the book. And unfortunately, that was how I discovered that The Outlaw Josie Wales was written by not only a Klansman, but by a guy who actually like reintroduced the Klan to the county that he lived in because it had fallen out of use.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was, and he was a fraud. He had this identity that he was a Sioux, like a Native American storyteller. But he was actually a white Klansman. Yeah. But look, you know, that's a tough one. The creator of the art versus the art itself.
Yeah.
But yeah. Okay. So corporations, yeah. Like corporations are always, they're always pushing this idea that actually, you know, you can succeed if you work hard enough. And that's why we're good, because we're the end product of that. Like the more money we make, the better things are going. Right.
Well, they have a vested interest in telling us the harder we work, the better off we'll be.
Absolutely.
I mean, that way we work harder, you know?
Yeah.
I think that at first, though, it was probably just, you know, like if you talk about like entertainment, just say entertainment only with the Westerns and that like an individualism that was in the Westerns in the 50s and 60s. I think that a lot of that was just capitalizing on what Americans dreamed about themselves. Because now you got to think about it. In the 50s and 60s, you have people whose grandparents lived in the Old West.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this is a memory, you know, this is a family memory for them.
Yeah. And the Old West started to be mythologized while a lot of those figures were still around. Like, Wyatt Earp used to go to movie sets and get drunk with extras and get drunk with stuntmen and stuff.
Like, of course, yeah.
It's an interesting period. Like, it's such a, it's so close to the modern era.
Well, yeah, but it was a brutal, brutal time, and medicine was a joke, and I mean, you died so easy, and nobody lived very long.
Oh, I mean, in terms of time, it's close to the modern era. I don't mean like in terms of experience. Yeah, yeah.
Interestingly, I've over the course of my travels through America, walked through many a house built in the Victorian era, I guess maybe.
Yeah.
You know, and all the doorways are really short. Those people were short.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
They were too. Like, even when I was a kid, man, look at all these tiny doorways and rooms.
Yeah, yeah. Hobbit Town.
Definitely Hobbit Town. Maybe I'm just a giant. I'm probably just a giant.
Yeah, you're just unreasonable.
So the other thing about the Myth of American Success, and I know we've been rambling terribly on this one, but I'm having fun, and it's the first time in a while. I don't know if our listeners are aware, but I fell and injured myself last week, and I haven't laughed since then, really heartily laughed, so.
Yeah.
If we're a little rambly, I apologize. I've been wrapped up in myself for a week. But I do want to, before we go, because I'm trying to keep these close to half an hour, and I know you are too, I do want to talk just a bit about how that myth of the rugged individualism has affected our body politic, because really that's kind of what bothers me about it the most, is it's more than just we won't come to the streets. It's that it enabled the right to move the conversation in their direction and make it seem patriotic to do so.
Right.
I would say that in like we'll use the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare.
Right.
That seemed like a tongue twister all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And I think about how the right successfully through messaging has gotten universal health care into people's heads, that it is the antithesis of what it means to be an American, a socialized health system, right?
Right.
And I think that anti-communism contributed to the rugged individualism myth, in that communism is the opposite of rugged individualism.
Yes.
And I feel that the right was able to easily grab that narrative and turn a universal healthcare package, like a single payer system, into something that is not just socialist, but anti-American, because we have socialist programs all over this country, public parks, public roads, public hospitals, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we do.
Yeah.
Utilities. But that's not evil socialism. Well, for some reason, healthcare is, and that's because they messaged around it for so long that they were able to take. Otherwise, I think maybe 50-50 healthy American attitude and turn it against people.
I think, you know, the old chestnut of like the power of names as well, because, you know, whatever, I remember reading a tweet a couple of years ago, you know, and this lady was saying, I just had an argument with my Uber driver because he wouldn't stop talking about how much he hates Obamacare, and ended the conversation by saying, and anyway, they should just completely replace it and just use the Affordable Care Act instead.
Right.
And, you know, that's a joke or whatever, but it's an attitude that, you know, you see all the time, this weird thing of like, you know, that's the same thing, right?
Look, dude, you know what? It was a no-brainer for them, when a party full of what they knew by then were their racist base.
Right.
It was a no-brainer for them to name it after the black guy to get them to hate it.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Are you going to take a black guy's money? Are you going to take a handout from a black guy?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. How evil is that, you know?
Honestly, the hatefulness of that is, it's breathtaking, but it actually breaks your heart to think about.
It's part and parcel for the Republican Party, man. And anyone that's in that party that doesn't see it, I want to feel bad for them, but if they've been told over and over again and they refuse to see it, I can't feel bad for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it comes a point where, you know, you just have to understand, hey, dude, what your party's doing is wrong.
Yeah.
I was talking with someone today, and it's come to a time where I don't think that party deserves to exist in its current iteration anymore. And that terrifies me, because I am just as scared of a one party rule from either side. I don't think that's healthy for any democracy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think two party rule is weird.
I bet you do.
Yeah. Like, I think there should be multiple parties, and there should be coalitions and all kinds of stuff, so that all kinds of ideas get a chance to be seen, you know?
Like, system doesn't lean itself to that because we're not parliamentary.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't really work. You know, like, every time there's a third party, they just get crushed.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I don't encourage third party voting in America.
No, I don't either.
But look, I'd love to see, I would love to see, you know, 30 years from now, that there is the Democratic Party on one side, and some new party that are further to the left of them are the other contender. I'd love to see that. You know?
Further to the left, I'd be okay with that, actually.
Yeah.
I think that might be the best. That might end up what happens. I haven't really pondered that too much, but I think that you're probably closer to what will end up happening than anything.
I would love it. I would love to see that. You know, I mean, it'd be tricky to pull off, but it could happen based on how things are going, you know? Could.
If you have one party that refuses to accept facts, like, they're already... They're already talking about messaging their way back into the majority rather than policing their way back into the majority.
Right. It's not about, it's not about a policy.
It's not about governing. And if you're not going to govern, you shouldn't be a party.
Yeah. Well, look at this thing with Paul Ryan, where he's like, you know, well, the things I regret are, you know, and he sort of says, well, you know, basically the Democrats didn't let me fix these problems. And they're all problems that he created.
Yeah. You
know, he regrets the deficit. You regret the deficit, motherfucker? The deficit? Like, that they blew this massive hole in to give away a massive amount of money to these...
Tax policies have been mathematically disproven for decades now. And they've refused to see the truth of it. And I believe that. Like, I believe the people in power have refused to see the truth of it. They've gone so far as to change how the CBO calculates debt and deficit, and it still doesn't work out for them.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It is a complete refutation of the facts. And that, again, in my opinion, with them, started with corporations when they got in bed with big tobacco and big oil.
Yeah.
The original obfuscator of facts, maybe would be a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Because definitely big tobacco paid a lot of fake scientists to, or sometimes even real scientists, to say what they wanted them to say.
Oh, yeah. For such a long time. For such it was one of those weird things where common sense came around a long time before science, officially anyway, came around, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, because it was paid for. It was an honest science, you know?
I think the power of this is one of those complicated thoughts where I lose myself halfway through. But I think the power of messaging was illustrated for me. I was watching SNL from this weekend, and there was some joke in it about how Trump is not gonna condemn MBS of Saudi Arabia because we need the oil, right? That was the joke,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, even if some dumbass like me who just reads the occasional newspaper is aware that America doesn't need Saudi Arabia's oil, even a little bit, and actually it's going to turn out it's some personal stake, right, that Trump has that he's protecting by doing this. America doesn't need Saudi Arabia's oil. But I think it always comes down to someone getting enriched. It doesn't have to be like a big, broad, you know, policy thing. Do you know what I mean? It's like somebody got their pockets lined enough to say, oh, well, we won't tax those guys. I don't think it's always ideological is what I'm saying.
Buddy. The myth of American success, buddy. It is ideological.
Oh, you brought it back around.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's endemic of, and we've sent that out to the rest of the world. Like, and I believe that, like with globalism, we sent out that ideal to the rest of the world.
Globalism is another one of those words that has become co-opted and complicated, right?
I refuse that. I mean business globalism.
I dig it, but...
No, I refuse that. I refuse to put that word to a particular group of people. I refuse to.
I respect what you're saying, and I respectfully counterpoint that I don't want to see people giving the okay symbol anymore, even if for a very long time it had nothing to do with white supremacy.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Let's be more specific about it then, okay? I think that our giving of the world to our economic system has put our myth of American success and rugged individualism out to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Would that be a better way of putting that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even bring that up, really. Sorry to criticize your use of the word. It just struck me because it was just another example of how messaging has swung around.
It is, and words matter, though. You're right. Words matter.
And just everyday language gets weaponized against us.
I refuse that, though. I can't, you know, it just goes back to the word racist, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think there's
I'm so mad they took Patriot from me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
That's
it's a tough one. Cause I've said this before, but I cringe at the way critics of Donald Trump use Trumpian language to criticize him. And I don't even like it when people use Trump style nicknames to make fun of him, because they're making that the discourse. They're making that the conversation. And I feel like the right wins, you know, when people make jokes where the punchline is fake news, I feel like that's a victory for the right. Even if they think they're highlighting something that the right has done that we've caught them in or whatever, it doesn't matter. The next day, some right wing asshole is saying, yeah, well, you know, if it's not a real thing, then why are even people on the left talking about fake news? you know?
I would counterpoint that.
Let's hear it.
I would actually harken back to George Carlin in the seven words you're not allowed to say on television. Do you get my meaning?
You automatically win any argument, in my opinion, once you're taking the George Carlin position.
If you invoke George Carlin, you automatically win.
It's like the old chestnut that you automatically lose an argument as soon as you compare someone to Hitler.
Yeah,
you automatically win an argument as soon as you invoke George Carlin.
I can live with that. He was right. He was wrong. You know, I mean, that was really the kind of the point of it, is that he was wrong. I mean, those words you can say on television now, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, eventually a word can come to a point where overuse makes it lose its potency.
I dig what you're saying. And I think it's very reliant on context. It's real, real specific. Because there are certain words that I feel the right, the nebulous right, okay, you know, that they want to see used more. And I won't use those words so much because I know that they want those words to be in the conversation. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. I can jive with that. And really, we're under no responsibility to accept the speech of someone who's using hateful words.
Yeah.
I think that that's a necessity to further discourse, to say, oh, well, yeah, you can use that word, even though it's hateful as hell. And I'm going to respond to it as though it were valid. Like, to me, it's okay to just shut someone like that down. You know, yeah, you know what? You're not really saying anything of value here, so I don't have to listen to you.
Yeah, and I think that there should be more of that, you know?
I think too. It's like if someone said the moon was made of cheese and they really believed it, I would say, well, you and I are no longer going to talk about the composition of the moon.
Yeah, look, a friend of mine from back in Dublin, she casually related to me a burn that she dished out a while ago that she didn't actually even mean as a burn, some like a right-wing dude was bothering her about something that she'd said on Twitter. But it turned into a thing where he was saying, well, then just debate me. And eventually she said, look, I'm not going to debate you. I don't even feel you really understand the terms you're using. So what I'm really doing is I'm not going to fucking educate you. Okay.
Right. Right.
And I think that's a wonderful burn. And it's also like, at a certain point, you're like, yeah, you know, you don't have to educate everybody. You can try and bring people around, but I think we spend too much time trying to reason with people who are just screaming the N-word over and over again.
Well, you know, and that goes back to what we were talking about, just to pick at you. You know, that someone who's screaming the N-word over and over again is that guy behind you throwing things at you, just trying to get at you. He doesn't care what you have to say. He's not going to listen to your logic or your reason. He just wants to get a rise out of you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I got time for people like that. Generally speaking, on social media, my response is, so you're an idiot. Good to know. And then I'll wait 10 minutes for them to read it and block them.
Yeah, I don't like to argue on them. I don't like to argue on social media at all, actually. I really don't.
It's just trolling. And I mean that in the old school gaming sense, as in like people who would come into a game, you know, and shoot their teammates the whole game long just to troll and make people mad, you know. I mean that in the sense of the guy who threw erasers at you from behind, you know. I mean, it's just trolling. Yeah. You know? And when I was a kid, I got into that, but I refuse. I'm not going to do that anymore.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. When I think about arguing on social media, I've just realized the only arguments I think I've had on, you know, on Twitter over the years have been rather depressingly a handful of arguments I've had with people that I knew that sort of drifted into misogyny or drifted into some terrible position like that. And at a certain point, I was like, oh, I can't actually talk to you anymore. But the arguments were the beginning of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I did.
Like, I did. Just they post something and you're like, what? You know, like, I think J.K. Rowling had said something about politics. And this Canadian dude that I knew, who's like a movie guy. He had like a movie blog. This Canadian dude was like, you know, why are we trusting some stay-at-home mom's opinion about politics? You know, I was like, what the fuck is wrong with you, man? You know, and it escalated and it turned into one of those, oh, well, I just I'm not going to talk to you anymore. But that, depressingly, over the last few years, those are the arguments I've had, not with strangers, but with people that I knew but didn't know them as well as I thought.
I don't usually interact with strangers too much on social media anymore. That, you know what I mean?
I don't know. I'm on social media to meet and interact with strangers, because that's how I end up knowing all these great people, you know?
Yeah, you're right. That was a ridiculous statement. I interact with strangers all the time on social media. Okay. I guess maybe strangers I don't know. No, that's stupid too. Strangers, I tried to steer clear of strangers that I don't agree with. How about that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I don't have time to find out why they want to pick at me.
Yeah. Yeah. Like strangers where from the outset it's like, okay, let's fight.
Yeah, that'd be a better way of putting it. I don't know. I'm full of ridiculous statements, so I'm okay with it.
Well, folks, I guess we're coming to the end of episode 4, and we just want to remind you, stay away from strangers you don't know. Those are the bad ones.
Those are the bad ones.
Yeah. All right. Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody.